The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The Biden administration and EPA are proposing new regulations for coal and gas-fired power plants. Now, this would be the first time that the U.S. has restricted carbon dioxide emissions from existing plants. Talk to us about how stringent these new regulations are.
These are very stringent. I mean, basically, existing gas and coal-fired power plants would have to cut their greenhouse gas emissions by about 90%. That leaves them with really just a couple of choices of how they comply with this. They can shut down the power plant altogether. They can switch to a cleaner form of energy like hydrogen, or they would have to install, and this is what most plants would end up doing, expensive carbon capture technology that basically sits on top of the smokestack. It captures that carbon before it can go into the atmosphere, and then that carbon is safely stored in tanks or underground. The problem with that, the industry says, is one, it costs a lot of money, and two, it's basically non-existent technology in the U.S. right now. There isn't a power plant anywhere in this country right now that is operating that way. So this would be a major overhaul of the power sector in the U.S. in pretty quick fashion.
Your electric bill could be going up starting June 1st, jumping from $53 per megawatt hour to around $101.
So the combination of higher power prices and suppliers being more risk averse, it's what's driving up these prices significantly.
Fresh data shows inflation right now is easing across the country. Meanwhile, core inflation, which excludes volatile energy and food prices, ticked up 0.4% between March and April. Elsewhere, it's a bit of a mixed bag. Energy prices increased and shelter prices rose 0.4%.
The White House warned the world's top AI developers of their moral and legal responsibilities to ensure the safety of their products. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris meeting with the CEOs of leading tech companies, including Microsoft, Alphabet, and OpenAI on Thursday. Harris warned of the risks of unregulated development of AI products, and the White House later announced plans for $140 million in new AI research.
That meeting came just days after one of the leading voices in the field of AI, Dr. Geoffrey Hinton, announced he was quitting Google over his worries about the future of AI and what it could eventually lead to unchecked. What are you free to express now about artificial intelligence that you couldn't express freely when you were employed by Google?
There are quite a few different risks. There's the risk of producing a lot of fake news so nobody knows what's true anymore. There's the risk of encouraging polarization by getting people to click on things that make them indignant. And then there's the risk of super intelligent AI taking over control from people.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
It was neither a week of breakouts or breakdowns for stocks as the bulls and bears continue to battle for control. Rates haven't budged much either this week, with the 2-year treasury moving down 3 basis points to 3.89, but the 10-year treasury yield was able to move up 17 basis points to 3.46%. Economic data through the week seems to support the idea of a Fed pause at the next meeting, with cooling inflation and softening of the labor market, but not enough to encourage the Fed to begin cutting rates anytime soon, like the market expects. The S&P 500 finished down 12 points to 4124. The 4,100 level seems to be supported all week, despite any negative news. The communications sector finished up 2.4% this week, and consumer discretionary finished second, up 0.4%. The rest of the nine sectors were flat to down, with energy down 2.1% and materials down 2% on growth fears. Continued weakness in the regional banks this week pulled the financial sector down 1.3%. In commodities, gold finished down $4 to $2,020.50 as it consolidates on its rally since March. West Texas crude fell a fourth week, but not by much, only down 47 cents to $70.87 a barrel. Copper made waves this week, falling through near-term support, down 17 cents on the week to $3.71, which is the likely reason material stocks didn't do so well. Turning to the events this week that caused the growth concerns were the weakness in regional bank stock performance and economic news. The rally and corrections in the bank stocks were volatile, but within a narrow range until Thursday. PacWest dropped sharply after the company said its deposits declined last week by 9.5%. On the same day, we saw copper drop sharply below support. In economic news, the April Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey Monday confirmed what we already have been hearing since March, that banks are tightening lending standards and they expect credit quality to deteriorate. Stocks fell sharply on the news, but rallied back throughout the day on Monday. Wednesday's consumer price index was up 4.9%, the first reading under 5% in 2 years, but the core was up 5.5% year over year in April. Expectations are holding that the Fed will pause with this information, but not cut rates anytime soon. The index for shelter, a segment of the CPI, was up 0.4% and the largest contributor, but it was also the smallest increase for that segment since January of 2022, which is a good sign. Thursday's producer price index showed continued moderation there, and unemployment claims reached their highest level since October 30th of 2021, after the claims data had been leveling off for some time. The report shows that the labor market is softening, which is what the Fed wants to see. These two reports Thursday were key in seeing rates drop after the reports, but they recovered soon after. Finally, Friday's University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey, with its higher inflation outlook, caused rates to climb. The survey showed an increase in the five-year ahead inflation to 3.2% from 3%, the highest since 2011, causing that two-year Treasury yield and 10-year Treasury yield to climb. This week was the start of political negotiations between the White House and leaders of Congress to increase that debt limit. Treasury Secretary Yellen had warned over the last weekend of economic chaos if the ceiling is not raised. All agreed they don't want a short-term fix, but both sides resorted to finger-pointing after their first high-level meeting, as both sides don't appear ready to compromise. Both sides decided, let's move this discussion back to the staff-level talks and postpone further high-level meetings between the White House and Congress. The nonpartisan budget office thinks the nation won't risk breaching the debt limit until the end of July, but in a worst-case scenario, the budget office said the Treasury Department could still run out of money to pay bills in the first 2 weeks of June. Right now, the event doesn't seem to be affecting stocks, but from the charts I was looking at this week, credit default swap rates, which is insurance on debt, were climbing and going as high as levels we haven't seen since 2008 and 2000 on U.S. debt. So the story will continue to develop and be a catalyst in the markets ahead. So volatility sideways trading in stocks this week, mostly flat move in rates, all as we continue to get growth concerns in economic news and angst over the way those regional banks continue to trade. Up next, this week's guest technician, Mish Schneider.
The United States last year, we imported about 74% of the rare earth minerals that we used in the U.S. from China. That actually kind of understates the Chinese control of the supply chains, because our next largest source for rare earths comes from a processing facility in Malaysia. But that is actually owned by a Chinese state-owned company.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At a time, bank deposits offer very low interest and could be at risk. Corporate cash accounts are also progressively losing ground to inflation. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we offer a solution to this problem. Our firm specializes in assisting companies by managing cash balances with short-term treasuries and high-quality corporate bonds that may provide higher interest rates. This approach not only helps to manage your corporate cash balances with competitive yields, but also to help reduce taxes through the use of treasury securities, which are exempt from state and local income taxes. Give us a call today at 888-486-3939 to find out how we can assist you to earn higher interest rates with no bank risk and no state and local income taxes. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining me on the program is Mish Schneider. She's chief strategist at MarketGage. Let's take it from the top on the major indexes here. It seems like they've just been going sideways, not really going anywhere. I'd like to get your take here.
Well, yes, and I think that that actually is a perfect reflection of where we are economically right now, which is not recession, certainly not expansion, inflation possibly peaked, but still pockets to be concerned about, which all to me equals stagflation. And we know from the past that stagflation can last a while. But what's so interesting is that, you know, in terms of what's happening in the overall economy and what the stock market is reflecting, this trading range is I call the good news and the bad news, right? Because what it's saying right here is that, yes, we did have the Federal Reserve just raise, but historically and seasonally, when we get to a Fed funds rate, about 5.25% hasn't been much higher in, you know, in I would say recently in the last 20 years, number one. And number two is May generally tends to be the top of the yields. And we can see this week that yields are starting to soften a little bit because PPI, CPI has been relatively optimistic. So I'm looking at two huge cycles, or one would be a smaller cycle within a bigger cycle. And it's so easily measured, not by crunching numbers as economists do, but by looking at two monthly or zooming out moving averages that reflect these cycles. One is an 80-month moving average, and that would really be sort of a 6 to 8 year cycle. And it's an interesting moving average. A lot of people don't know about it. I will give credit to where credit's due. It's the Aiden sisters in Costa Rica that first turned me on to that. And essentially what it's showing is where the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ are far from the 6 to 8 year business cycle lows. The Russell 2000, the retail sector, even the transportation sector have all landed on it and are holding. And of course, the exception to that rule would be the regional banks for obvious reasons. So what I'm finding interesting in terms of supporting the trading range theory is that unless we see small caps, retail, or transportation break below that, that could be the real wall of support. So it translates in numbers, IWM, it would be at around 167, 170. If we want to translate that, looking at XRT for the retail sector, which I really like because it's a broad exposure to all different kinds of retail, that would be at around 56. The low so far and most recently has been around 60. And if we want to look at IYT, you know, it would be closer down to around 118, 119, and it's trading now at around 124, 125, 126. So what that's telling me is that from a longer term business cycle, we've tested the lows and we're holding. So maybe this deep recession that everybody's anticipating is not going to happen. Now, with that said, that's not necessarily great news because it doesn't mean we're going to start rallying from here, but it does at least mean we have a point to look at.
You know what really struck me is last weekend, Warren Buffett had his annual Berkshire meeting. And one of the things he came across, and of course, he owns a wide swath of companies, but he said he's seeing a downturn in earnings across a wide spectrum of Berkshire holdings, which gets back to your kind of stagflation where, you know, the economy isn't really growing, but it's not into a recession. The other thing that I would think would hold that up, Mish, is the Biden administration has put forth like $7.5 trillion of new spending.
Yeah.
They're talking about the new budget, which is going to be increased spending again. So there's a lot of fiscal spending that's being pushed into the economy. To me, I think it's one reason it's been holding up.
Absolutely. I mean, essentially, we still have a lot of liquidity being added, and it's the reason why we are holding up. But it could be a chicken egg. It could be we hold up, and then just in terms of cycles, things start to improve because the labor market is still strong, and some of the supply chain issues we've had over the course of the years have already abated. And because things begin to normalize more after COVID, I mean, you can't discount that what happened with COVID was, you know, hopefully a once in a lifetime event and have major repercussions. But, you know, I just want to go one step further with this business cycle, because my husband and I, Keith, who's the CEO of Market Gauge, we were looking at this guy, Benner, who was alive in the 1800s, and he wasn't even an economist. He obviously was an investor. He invented an ammonia-based system for refrigeration, but he was a genius. He had lots of different patents, and he came up with this 2-year business cycle within the longer term business cycle. And he has all this data that's been charted out since. And essentially that 2-year business cycle is so important. I can't tell you, Jim, how many times now that, and we're using a 23-month moving average, the prices, including the SPY and the NASDAQ, have hit it and come off. Semiconductors are sitting right there. The Dow sort of pierced it and now has come through. In other words, what it's telling us is that we may not go into this deep recession. And of course, if the Russells break down, I might change that tune. But we're not necessarily going to see any kind of any sustained expansion anytime soon. And part of it is obviously because the economy may have contracted enough, but doesn't have enough legs to actually do anything to expand. So that's where I'm at right now. And I'm sort of forecasting that if we end the month here, kind of at these lower regions that we saw in the Russells or even a little bit higher, then we might start to see at least maybe a test of that two-year business cycle in the stronger areas. And then we see how much the Russells can actually catch up to that. But expect a sideways range in the indices and a lot of the sectors, I think, persisting for quite some time.
I want to move on to another area. Last time you were on the program, you were pretty bullish on gold. I'm looking at a chart of gold. It looks like it's been trying to take out that 2000 level. We've had three attempts. We got up almost a new high, and then we pull back. What's your take on gold here? It seems to be holding up fairly strong.
Well, yes, I was so extremely bullish for gold for a couple of years and was a big dip buyer. And now that we're sort of here at this wall of resistance, it seems, and again, crowded, everybody, including Druckenmiller, so bullish gold, although I don't really like being bullish gold, but I'm so, you know, negative in the market. I think what's happened with gold right here is exactly fits into what we just talked about, which is if the worst of it is over and we survive more banks crashing or we actually get a pass on the debt ceiling, and I'd love to know what you think about that, and things stay relatively status quo, it's possible that gold can have a nice correction here. We've actually tightened. Gold has been our best trade for quite some time. But in terms of just, you know, prediction, discretionary, getting in, quants modeling it afterwards because of the trend strength indicators, and now looking at profit taking, I've taken profits and have a tail. And we are, and this is on the discretionary side, have just tightened our stops to under April low. So here's what I would say. If we break down under the April low, we're going to see a deeper correction. Obviously, if we can get through this 2080 level, then, you know, 2200, hello, real fast. And right here, just like the market, except on a higher level, stuck in a range.
You know, the thing that really strikes me, we're coming up on this debt ceiling, and only in Washington, if you want to increase spending by 8% and you cut back that increased spending to 5%, would that be counted as a budget cut? But that's the way they think in Washington. What really strikes me about what I'm seeing is the interest level on what the government is paying on its debt. All those T-bills that were at 0.1% are rolling over. We're getting to the point where we're almost getting to $1 trillion just in interest costs. And I guess because election's coming up, you're going to have this show. Either side doesn't want to back down from what their positions are. And they take us almost to the brink of jumping off a cliff. And then at the last minute, they solve it. It seems like a kabuki show that we have every time they want to do this.
Personally, my gut is that it'll be resolved, but I wanted to know what you thought.
I think they're going to resolve this. There's just too much at stake here. I mean, it's bad enough that, you know, people are moving out of the dollar, but, you know, the treasury market is probably one of the largest, most liquid markets in the world. And if people start having concerns about the safety of that market, that has huge implications for the United States. So I think they'll take it to the last hour. And then finally, they'll come up with, you know, some kind of proposal over the weekend, and we avoid the cliff.
Totally agree with you. I mean, you and I were around in 2011. And, you know, just I'm no political analyst, so I don't even want to pretend to be. But just in terms of repeating history, right? So look what happened in 2011. They let it go. Everything crashed. Market went down 20-30%, which, by the way, was an unbelievable buy opportunity. And in terms of what happened as far as the 2012 election, Obama was president in 2011, he got reelected. It did not help Republicans. It was a bad taste in Americans' minds that the political footballing or the kabuki theater, as you put it, affected people so badly. So yeah, I'm with you. I kind of think that we'll get a pass on that. But then that completely supports the fact that we may have seen enough economic contraction. Now, whether the debt and the interest on the debt comes back to haunt us in the future remains to be seen. But right now, other factors that are far more concerning down the road. You know, we still have some geopolitical factors. We still have some major food shortages. We still have certain commodities that are reflecting issues. And I know you wanted to talk about oil, so this would be a good time to discuss that.
Just a final comment on the debt ceiling. We have an election year coming up next year. And I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat, you don't want to go into an election year. The economy's in a recession. The unemployment rate is growing. The stock market's down 20, 30%. That's bad news. But let's move on to oil here, because we've got OPEC has had a tough time meeting its production targets. They're talking about maybe possibly cutting again. We've got some political outbreaks in countries like Nigeria that production is falling down. But I'm looking at the futures market and the short sellers are back in control of the market. What's your take on oil as you look at the charts?
Well, it's been an X factor for a while, because even though everybody's celebrating that it hasn't gone up much in terms of the price of Brent or West Texas, I think the Brent's trading at around 75, West Texas probably around 71, 72 a barrel. That's still pretty damn high. I was an oil trader way back in the 80s. And, you know, we were talking about $20, $30 a barrel was high back then. And of course, based on the cost of inflation, you know, it probably makes more sense where it is now. But yeah, I think we have to keep our eye on it. And if, let's say, Brent gets through $80 a barrel, that's my number in my head right now, then I think that we could have a whole other inflationary issue. One of the things that came out with the PPI was that consumers have gotten a little bit of a break from the peak as far as electricity and gas and utilities, which is all sort of kind of tied to not only interest rates, obviously, but also tied to the prices of energy and oil. So that could really hurt everything. You know, we're low on our own strategic reserves here in the United States. And I think we're playing with fire a little bit, to use somewhat of an energetic pun. Because we also have some issues in Middle East, too. I mean, Israel and Syria have been going at it, and Iran. I mean, you know, any of those things, they're all ticking time bombs. I wouldn't get negative in the energy. I'm not bullish yet. It's just another one of these sectors that's just sideways and making it very, very tough for people to get their sink their teeth into the next trend.
Yeah, I'm looking at China's economy coming back. I'm looking at inventory levels that are below five-year averages. And as I follow that, we see oil prices higher at the end of the year. And the one thing that strikes me on that, if that happens, you know how that feeds through on inflation in the economy. What does the Fed do? They can't create barrels of oil. The only thing they can do is kill off demand. So, and then you're moving into an election year. So it's going to be, I don't know, what's your take on how this plays out?
Well, you're laying this out so well, because it actually is exactly, I think you and I have talked about this now, is that the Fed has really, they backed themselves into a corner. And even though the rate of how fast they've raised the interest rates has been blinding to a lot of people, you know, we're still somewhat 5 to 7% interest rates on buying a home historically is not crazy. It's kind of where the norm is. And that's part of the reason why I think maybe we'll get a little bit of a pass in terms of the economy, you know, if these things don't explode. But in terms of the Fed, they've proven themselves to be reactive, not proactive. So that's what will probably happen again. But, you know, right now it's so hard to worry about that. And will they basically say, okay, well, we'll go up another 0.25% if oil goes crazy to try to squash demand? I think it's going to really depend on so many other factors. It's not the only factor anymore. And that's why the Federal Reserve has lost so much credibility, which in and of itself is inflationary, right? When central banks start losing their credibility.
And you take a look at, it's not just us raising interest rates, it's happening around the globe, and they've got budget problems and deficit problems just like we do. So given, as you look at this right now, I want to bring up this question. You know, you hear this, sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day. We're talking about this sideways action. And do you think that's what we see this summer? It just goes nowhere, up and down, and just sort of a consolidating pattern here.
Yeah, I kind of do. That is exactly what I think. I think we could persist like this into 2024. And then, you know, we'll sort of reevaluate as we start looking into 2025. But the sell in May and then, you know, come back Labor Day, I think that what we've really seen since COVID is that any platitude, cliche, or even conventional wisdom in terms of a definition of anything has changed. This is really the market of a square peg, round hole. And once you try to spit that square peg into a round hole, like sell in May, you could really wind up getting hurt. So I think it's much, much better to anticipate this trading range. If you are a passive investor, obviously you've already taken your big hit, and I don't even know what to say about that. I mean, obviously fixed income has become much more attractive with the higher interest rates. And if you want to have some speculative money in the market, you know, I know it's talk about a cliche, but, you know, try to buy low, sell high in anticipation of this trading range. And then if we break out or below that trading range, then the conversation changes to how much follow through do we get? Or is it just, you know, basically a lot of retail investors piling in, whether it's, you know, in the options trading or what have you? The retail investor has become less and less visible compared to where they were during the meme movement and then with the ODPE stories, because I think people are starting to realize this is tough, and this is tough, but everything passes eventually, and this will too.
Yeah, and it's sort of one of those kind of markets. I don't know about you, but we're keeping a sizable position in treasuries, Mish. This is the first time in nearly two decades where I can't remember getting close to 5% or more on treasuries. And it's not a bad place to hide out until this thing plays out.
Absolutely. And that also will take money out of the market, right? Because people are taking their money out of the market and putting it into these safer assets like treasuries. And that's exactly what people should be doing right now, as long as they can move things relatively quickly if things change. And of course, no one's ever going to call a bottom, just like nobody can really call a top. But we can certainly say that, like I said, good news, bad news is that the market's in a trading range, which means it should, with everybody watching the same thing, should at least give us some momentum up or down when that range breaks. And I think we do have to keep an eye on the oil, just to go back to that. I think the gold is telling us that right now, the anticipation is the dollar held, by the way, at a very key critical support level, so it's bouncing a little bit, that right now things are, maybe the worst is over. And that's kind of, that's hopeful. I wouldn't necessarily say run in and buy everything you can, but I would say at least we know that if the worst is over, it's going to match, if any indicator, it's going to match two things. One would be the small caps, again, like I said, because if the small caps start collapsing after the banks have collapsed, then we have two members of my economic modern family in the skids. And two is really keep your eye on the yields and the bonds, and not just the long bonds, but the long bonds relative to the high corporate grade bonds, and also the junk bonds, which amazingly are doing better than a lot of the different sectors right now. We have junk bonds entering an accumulation phase, which means they're clearing their 200-day moving average. And we have the high-grade corporate bonds in a bullish phase. So, you know, I know that economists will start to shake if I bring that out. Oh, it's too small to look at. But it is a factor amongst the other factors, I think, to keep in mind. If that is basically relaying that maybe yields have peaked, maybe, you know, barring any unforeseen horror show, inflation, at least in certain levels, have peaked. And maybe our economic contraction, based on the speed of how fast interest rates were raised after COVID, has also paused. And that's kind of right now where I'm going.
Well, I think focusing on yield and on our side, we're focusing on dividends are not a bad place to be. At least you're getting cash flow when you're waiting for this thing to sort itself out. Mish, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work at MarketGauge, tell them more about that.
Well, basically, we have two companies. We have a financial publishing company, and that's what MarketGauge is, and that is MarketGauge.com. And we provide a lot of free content with my daily blog, and we write an outlook where we give a lot of information about the market internals. Plus, we have quant models and tools and things for the trader to help the trader. And then we have a registered investment advisory company called MGAM LLC, where we're doing something very unique in that we've created a plethora of quant models that take advantage of everything from the global macro to sector rotation. For example, they've been heavy into the metals this year and in the miners. And that's where, you know, you can put assets under management where we have a percentage in some of the safety plays, like you're mentioning, fixed income, and then also some money based on what's happening in terms of the sectors that are doing better. So that those are the two things I'm involved with right now.
All right. Well, listen, Mish, it's a pleasure having you on the program. You have yourself a great weekend and come back again.
Thank you, Jim. I'd love to. And you have a great weekend as well.
People from Microsoft are very much embracing the model of move fast and break things from Silicon Valley. So they're embracing AI with both arms. But that's one of the reasons why Microsoft's share price has jumped. Then you have Nvidia, where they have been building these AI chips for several years already. So that was the go-to stock for people to play the AI revolution. But we're already at really aggressive multiples.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
One of the best performing investments over the last couple decades would surprise you. It's been gold. It's actually done better than the stock market. And now, as we take a look at gold, ready to set new records, where does it go from here? Well, let's find out. Joining us on the program is Frank Holmes. He's CEO and Chief Investment Officer at U.S. Global Investors. Frank, I want to talk about the gold market here. We've seen just the other day, we touched 2085. And as we take a look at all the things that are going on with, whether it's the debasement of currencies, I have seen the largest buying of gold by central banks in the last couple of years. What's your take here?
Well, there's several factors. The world starts coming to a financial end with rising interest rates, and they're going to peak probably here short term at 5.5%, maybe 6, but that's still way below inflation. And if you use the old algorithm, because it's changed again many times over the past 40 years. If you go back to 1980, when inflation hit, rates hit 20%, that what we witnessed then, that algorithm would say inflation is running at 14%. So it means that with interest rates, when they went over 4% earlier this year, you saw money leave banks at a rapid rate to go in search of a higher yield. And this caused a bank contagion. And so I think that rates, that inflation is not going to fall down to 2%. It's priced in there that rates are going to fall 6 to 8 times. So what is that? That is 2% to 3% decline. That's still going to be a negative real interest rate. And I think more and more people are waking up that we're going to be living with negative real interest rates. And gold is always one of the best decentralized assets globally, with the historical significance of centuries of protecting against fiat money.
Frank, what about some of the competition that we've seen come in gold over the years? You know, we got the ETFs in the OO decade. Now we have cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Has that taken some of the luster away from gold, in your opinion?
What happens is that when we look at the total world of assets and the trillions of dollars, and you take a look at gold, gold is 1%. 1%. Bitcoin is a tiny component of that. It's a bleep in all the financial related assets globally. So I don't think that Bitcoin has done that significant. But what it has done, it is it relates to the new investors coming on stream that are going to inherit, Jim, your money and my money. And those kids and our grandkids, there's an affinity towards digital money because they've been rewarded with digital money on gaming. When you look at mobile gaming that does $6 billion in revenue because it can have kids do gaming from 32 countries or 32 different languages by processing 500 million instructions per second. So they all communicate, they game, they get digital money if they're good. They're used to it. You and I grew up with Monopoly money, and the reality is they're addicted to winning digital money. And so it makes it easier for them. The other part was onboarding to open an account. I just flew back from Milan. I was meeting with CEOs in the luxury business. It was interesting to see that they're all taking digital money, Mercedes-Benz, LVMH, Dolce & Gabbana. So there is this push in that direction going in that sort of that direction, that path. So I don't think so, but I think you have to really understand that they produce about 90 million ounces of gold a year, but the total universe of Bitcoin, they've only produced 19 million coins, and there's the cap at 21 million. So there is a cap. There is a digital acceptance in the great digital transformation of the world of digital money. So I think having a 2% in Bitcoin or crypto mining companies, if you're worried about opening an exchange because of all the calamities, that's one reason why we created Hive Blockchain Technology, which was the first crypto mining company, uses only green energy. And we hodl as much Bitcoin as we can in running the business. So that was our proxy in that new asset class. But I think that's what's really important is that you see art and you notice like master art marketing heavily where all the money they've made. I think which when you want to look at the world, you have to look at what's called alternative asset classes. And within that, you have to look at what asset classes which are decentralized. The most significant one is gold, then it's silver. And then you start going into things like art. You've seen incredible growth in Andy Warhol's art when he has the limited editions in particular, like limited stamp production, limited art. And then you have the Bitcoin and you have Ethereum. But I really am more focused on proof of work, which is like making a brick of gold, but you're making a digital asset. That is what Bitcoin is. And I see that people have to look at the world differently for what's portable, such as assets like Bitcoin. You also found, you won't believe this, Jim, but luxury goods. You know, Hermes purses, they limit the supply of 2 purses per person per year. So you walk into an Hermes store and you see these beautiful purses, you can't buy them. If you're not on the approved list. Really? Oh, yes, you have to be on the approved list. And you can only buy 2 of those purses a year. And when you walk out the store, if you're lucky to get 1 in a year, they're 3 times the price because of limited supply. So all this money printing, and when we see all the money in the Middle East and we see other places, is this the movement towards getting limited versions. And it was also, I noticed that exclusive art, like you can buy Dolce & Gabbana earrings for $100,000. And what do people do? They buy them, and then they get knockoffs done for $2,000. And the women wear the $2,000 ones where they make an investment in the limited version. And that's what's going on. So people are looking for those types of assets that are decentralized, where there's limited version of them. And the other big new dynamic growth has been NFTs, non-fungible tokens. And the idea that you can put art in there and now you can use artificial intelligence and you can create the year of the bunny, which is this year, of 1,000 bunnies. Each one is going to be different. And there's a company I've invested in called Matador, and they'll be coming out with art. And behind each NFT will be 1 gram of gold in addition to a bunny, a gold bunny, which will only be that version of that bunny. So I think these sort of decentralized assets like NFTs, the people at the CEO of Dolce & Gabbana was telling me they made a lot of money with their NFTs. And so I think that the growth, what you're seeing is that for kids to onboard, it's so lengthy and difficult to open a bank account, never mind a brokerage account. But when I came back into America, I didn't even get the chance to put my passport in. It immediately recognized me with facial recognition. And then I just had to hold up my passport going through. And why can't banks do this? So a lot of the theory is that there's a lot of bank lobbying trying to push back on the growth and the success of peer-to-peer money and to be able to flow with money. And you think of that with the NFT business, that you can send that and trade that all over the world. Well, it's very disruptive, like Uber was, to art galleries. So art galleries is where you buy your decentralized Andy Warhol or Picasso pieces of art. But the commissions there can be up to 50%. For Sotheby's, it's 25%. When you do OpenSea's, it's 2.5%. So you can see the art galleries are being disrupted with this NFT system that's growing. And I think we're going to see that proliferate globally.
Frank, how would you explain, you know, we've seen central bank buying, we've seen investor buying. One of the things that really strikes me, and this is the first time I've seen this in decades, and that is the premiums on sovereign coins. I mean, if you go to Kitco, try to buy a Silver Eagle, I've seen premiums up to 80%. There's premiums at 25, 30% on gold eagles. What explains that in your opinion?
That's a classic, isn't it? You know, supply and demand. The world sees demand and they see that inflation has been coming and has steadily been understated. The largest hedge fund in the world, Ray Dalio's Bridgewater, they do parity trading with gold. They go from 10 to 35% with gold, hedging against countries' currencies and stock investments. They love gold royalty companies like our GOAU ETF. And so we see that who's the biggest hedge fund? Oh, they always have gold as a proxy. Shouldn't you? And I think that you're seeing witness that if you limit supply of any product and you increase the demand, the price grows exponentially. So I've been saying this to people that I don't think silver premiums are going to fall. I think the price of silver has to rise. I think the gold price has to rise to be more relating to that premium, because that's really reflecting where real demand is. Not the futures market, not where you've had central, not the central banks, but the major money center banks. The money center banks have been charged, found guilty, allowing traders to go and manipulate the price of gold, silver, currencies, etc. So I think that the real market is that premium.
Frank, what about also base metals? Because all we hear about is this green transition, the Green New Deal. All of this transition to a green economy takes raw materials. I don't care if it's copper, cobalt, lithium, various metals, even silver when you're talking about solar. And yet we're not seeing, you take a look at some of the inventories for copper and other strategic metals, they're at an all-time low. That's number one. And number two, we haven't been making a lot of major discoveries. And number three, a lot of these companies, even the gold mining companies, are going to lower grades, meaning they have to mine more dirt to get the metal out of the ground.
Well, it's not just that, Jim, you have to look at is the great geopolitical risk of what China's doing. You know, China has taken over so many of the operations in Africa. Now they've moved aggressively in Latin America. They took 2 million of their soldiers and made 2,000 security guard companies. So they basically are like the Wagner Group used by Putin. They have them, supposedly there's 500,000 Chinese working and running the oil fields in Venezuela, that they have been aiding and supporting the big sweep that's taken place in Latin America by left-wing governments. Well, what are the left-wing governments doing? They're all of a sudden cutting deals with China, and it's more and more difficult for public companies to raise money. So you're going to see supply disruptions continue, which is going to be embedded for inflation. So all this infrastructure spending is going to become very desperate for getting those resources. So if you look at, to me, it's interesting, in lithium, stocks took off on a tear like Lithium Sigma. And who the early investors were really the young kids buying Bitcoin. They're all into what do the climate change metals need, and they're jumping in to play that space. And the other big speculative one now beside that is called Atlas Lithium, and it's got the assets right beside the Sigma, which is multi-billion dollar company. And these are lots of shorters in there, all that game that's going on. I think one has to recognize that the government policies are a precursor to change. We said they say that in all of our prospectuses, and that's why we monitor both monetary and fiscal policies. And whenever there's an imbalance, gold shines. So since this century started, China came in the WTO, then we have the crisis in 2009, then we have other big push by climate change fanatics like World Economic Forum. You're seeing that gold has been a positive 80% of the time. 80%. And gold has outperformed the S&P 500 2-1. Gold, interesting enough, since COVID, the volatility of gold is less than the S&P 500. So gold is a classic example. And the other thing is, since 2013, back then, or the 100 gold producers we follow globally, there weren't 20 gold producers with positive free cash flow. Today, there's 63. So the industry, the gold stocks are the cheapest buy, and I think you can have huge gains there. I know that our GOAU's outperform the index GO, GDX, and GDXJ, mainly because it's a smaller portfolio focused on royalties and companies with high free cash flow yields. So you are seeing some, you know, interest go into that space. And when we look at the copper, I think copper stocks are great buys. I think lithium is going to continue to be a big buy. I think we're going to get a battle for supply. The China's going to try to squeeze out all North American companies in what they're doing in Latin America and Africa. People don't realize that in West Africa, 14 countries have been controlled by the French. They have their own currency, two-tier currency. So they basically rape and pillage the African countries with cheap commodities for their nation. But however, underneath, China's been growing rapidly through West Africa. And all of a sudden now, you see in geopolitics of Ukraine, China cuts a deal with France, and we're seeing this geopolitical debate of trying to weaken the U.S. dollar. So China's been a steady seller of U.S. dollars. China's increasing their gold exposure as a central bank because it was the only way they could get the Saudis to take their currency for oil. They had to have more gold. This was known 5 years ago. And what you're seeing, which is the big shocker, is central banks continue to buy more gold with rising interest rates. Historically, they want to trade currencies to get a higher yield, but the global instability and the battle against the U.S. dollar would break countries, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, creating their own sort of currency to try to dismantle the U.S. dollar. This is creating a greater interest in gold as a decentralized asset class. It is also for Bitcoin world, it's a decentralized asset class. And I think we're going to continue to have interviews like this to talk about how much of a portfolio should be an alternative asset classes, which ones are really decentralized and not controlled by a central bank or a government.
You know, one of the things I like, Frank, and you touched upon it, the cash flow of a lot of these mining companies, for the first time that I can recall in nearly two decades, you're getting some dividends of 3%, 4%, and 5% in gold miners. I hadn't seen that in two decades. How about yourself?
No. And you know, I was speaking at the biggest institutional conferences 8 years ago, and I was expressing this, that boards have been remiss in their responsibilities, and there's been huge dilution of bad mergers. And so when you see a company say, oh, yes, but our top line is going to grow and our cash flow is going to grow on a merger, but when you do it on a per share basis, it's actually dilutive. So that's why the stocks kept underperforming. And what we do is we focus only on those stocks where transactions are accretive or we sell. And I think that companies are recognizing that if boards of directors are recognizing they have to do accretive transactions or they're not going to get non-gold fund buyers. If you want to get a generalist to buy, then I share with you, you have to go and look at companies like Franco Nevada. I was with a Fidelity fund manager, manages $30 billion, and his exposure to gold is through Franco Nevada because they get over 100 royalties from various countries in different phases of the cycle. They don't have to worry about picking junior stocks or growth stocks. They focus on buying Franco Nevada. Bridgewater shows up, oh, it's owning Franco Nevada. Renaissance Technology. They also own Wheaton Precious as a royalty company. And Wheaton Precious Minerals has many royalties on both small cap to big cap. So I do think that the management boards are much more disciplined on protecting the value metrics per share.
So, Frank, given where we are right now, given the fact that inflation is unlikely to get down to 2%, especially with the spending and probably the possibility that the Fed at some point is going to end up cutting, what would you be doing? Would you be buying individual stocks? Or if you don't have the expertise to do that, talk about U.S. Gold Fund.
Well, I'm very biased. We have the only mutual fund that really buys junior mining stocks called World Precious Minerals. And to the other spectrum is our ETF, GOAU. AU is, as you know, the element ticker symbol for gold. So it's Go Gold, and it's quant-based. It's done what it said it would do. It's a de minimis fee, 60 basis points. We rigorously look at it every quarter. It has the three biggest royalty companies owning 30%. They rebalance 10% each quarter. And then we pick other stocks which have these other key metrics, which are backtesting going back now for 15 years of rigorous detail of over 10,000 hours of research. These factors will outperform a basic market cap weighted gold index. And so that's where I recommend that people have, you know, the 10% weighting in gold, and you rebalance. You try to buy the flea markets if you can. But you try to buy that 18 to 22 karat gold jewelry at discounts. I think that there's opportunities there for that really shrewd investor that wants to buy something for Mother's Day. You go buy some gold jewelry. I was also blown away of Cartier, because gold has gone up, but the Cartier watches have gone up dramatically. And I think that you have to think this way. You go and buy high quality gold jewelry, and you think of gold trading at such a premium. So is it really a big premium for high quality? Don't buy the Walmart 10 karat gold, 14 karat. You have to go 18, 22 value. And I think that these will become collector's items. Classic would show you when you go to a Nike store, they don't have pennies, nickels, or quarters or dimes. There's a shortage. So not only is there a shortage of physical silver and gold, and that's why that premium is, they won't even deal in pennies and quarters. And I bought thousands of pennies recently from 1964 because the copper is worth 5 cents. I bought them for a penny. I thought that was a great buy. You know, it's eclectic buying, Jim. And it's fun. You know, it keeps your brain active, that you're always, you know, trying to look for great value metrics or stocks. Like the dividend policy for Wheaton Precious is defined by the gold and silver prices. And as gold and silver goes higher, they give you a higher payout. There was a company which Ian Telfer's become the chairman, and it's called Aris, A-R-I-S. It's a very inexpensive gold producer in Latin America. But for my funds and myself, I love their gold royalty, their gold notes. So they have a gold note listed on the NEO Stock Exchange in Canada, and it's basically trades at par, 98, or even though rates have gone up, and bonds have fallen dramatically, not that gold note. And it pays 7.25%, and it pays on a monthly basis. It doesn't give you 7.25% monthly, that's annualized, but you're getting paid that yield. And as the price of gold goes up, you get bonuses. So gold goes to 5,000, you will get huge bonus payments every quarter. And they're buying back that bond every quarter. So if you put $1 million in, you slowly see, and you only have $700,000 because they keep buying it back. So I like those type of investments, Aris gold notes listed in Canada. That's for your Canadian listeners. It's very difficult for U.S. investors to buy that unless they have a Canadian account. And buying the royalty companies, yes, because they have a very well-defined dividend policy for the upside.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, as we close, you want to give out your website, please.
USfunds.com. And subscribe to the Frank Talk and Investor Alert. If you're not, we have 100,000 readers in 80 countries. So please come and join us.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, thanks for being so generous of your time. You have yourself a great weekend.
Same with you, and happy investing.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says contact us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.